You're listening to Reflections, the wisdom of Edgar Cayce. I'm Art Ray. Today's guest is Robert Ojado. Robert Ojado, author of the best-selling book, Transforming Fate into Destiny, A New Dialogue with Your Soul, is a world-renowned radio show host, intuitive counselor and coach, and pioneer presence in the fields of multisensory development and human consciousness. Highly sought after for his dynamic lectures and intuitive consultations, Robert challenges the conventions of mind-body-spirit paradigms by integrating intuitive perception, archetypes, and the subconscious mind. He'll be speaking at the upcoming conference at the ARE in Virginia Beach, Transforming Your Fate into Destiny, A New Dialogue with Your Soul. To find out more, go to edgarcayce.org, click on Events, and click on Conferences. To find out more about Robert Ojado's work and his radio show, go to ojado.com. That's ohotto.com. Thank you for coming on the show today.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Could you tell us about your book, Transforming Fate into Destiny, A New Dialogue with Your Soul?
Sure. I wrote this book because I felt that as I was looking at the movement within the genre of spirituality, self-help, and metaphysics, I was looking at that genre, which of course I live and breathe in, and seeing what was really lacking in terms of a modeling for, I think, what we need now in the evolution of our culture as a foundation to understand purpose. And so through my work as an intuitive all these years, I've become very aware that we have, one could say, two fundamental agreements with life. And we agree to these things to emerge into a journey of consciousness in our lifetime. And one could say that one agreement is with fate and the other agreement is with destiny. And furthermore, part of the agreement, really the third part of this, is that we are called to transform our fate into destiny. So fate to me is, on a very basic, mundane level, the coordinates your soul has chosen to engage as part of your life path on the earth. So very basically, I mean, we could look at our families that we're born into, the culture we're born into, the bodies we're born into, and all of the DNA and the patterning that comes with that. And also, on top of that, we could look at, very significantly, the time in history in which we were born. We're in the timeline of this creative process called Earth School, where we're born. And all of this constitutes choices that the soul has already made that your ego, as it develops, catches up with. So, for example, I mean, now that I'm, 40 years old here on planet Earth, I can't, decide I wish I would have had a different family, or would have been born at a different time in history, or would have been born in a different culture. These things weren't something that I, through my ego, chose. Something else in me chose this container for me to engage life and to have a trajectory of purpose through. And this is sort of a universal truth for everybody. It's a more challenging thing to swallow when we maybe are born into really harsh circumstances or have these experiences in our childhood that are really challenging to surmount and heal. But the fundamental truth of the choices of the soul still remains. And I think that destiny starts to become, what do you do in the alchemization, in the transformation of these choices you've made? And so, for example, if I was born into, which is true for me, I really was born into a crazy alcoholic addict home as a kid, and all of the abuse and the abandonment that comes with that, I have choices now in my life as part of my journey of fate to destiny in terms of what am I going to do with the hand that I got dealt? Because I didn't with my ego choose that hand, something else did. And by the time I start to mature my consciousness and develop this thing called the ego, which is my identity in this lifetime, I'm going to have to make some decisions about and get choice points about, well, what am I going to do with these wounds? And we all have our hand. We've all been dealt this hand by life and whatever it is. And so fate to destiny is really about, well, what do you do with what life's put on you? And life will continue to put on you, by the way, throughout the whole of your lifetime. And how do you make it, how do you alchemize that? How do you transform whatever comes at you into something that can affirm your life and serve and affirm the life of other people. So destiny is what, how we play the hand. And that's where we have power. We don't have power to go back and try to undo. And a lot of people waste a lot of their life, you know, trying to kind of look at the hand they got dealt and bitch about it and wish that they had gotten the aces instead of the, you know, the twos that they got dealt or whatever it is. And there's no power there. We don't have power there. And so I wrote this book because I thought, you know, it's time that we really got down to looking at some fundamental pieces that constitute the human journey universally. I mean, transforming fate into destiny is a lifelong process each and every one of us is bound to as part of an earth life. And what, at the time I wrote the book, I mean, there was a lot of brouhaha going around about the law of attraction and all these other things in metaphysics as if those were the only laws of the universe. And so I also felt at the time that what I could offer through my work and my experience in life was a model that really brought some maturity to our understanding of where we have power and where we don't. And because once you know where you have power, then you can get on with it. Then you can get on with really maxing out your potential in this lifetime. But if you start to hang yourself into where you don't have power and chasing dreams that weren't meant for you, then you kind of end up losing steam. And as many people probably will relate to this, you feel stuck. So this book, another component of this is that I don't think any of us transforms our fate into destiny without looking at our shadow. And this is, you know, the unconscious part of who we are, which is also kind of a doorway right to the soul as well. Because you have your ego awareness, which is, you know, who you feel you are and what you've been conditioned to think of yourself in this lifetime through your environment. And then you have the soul, which is kind of lying underneath that, that continues, hopefully, to waken bit by bit into your awareness in terms of the essence of self that you really are. And a lifetime is really about how do you negotiate the awakening and engage the awakening of the soul, and then let the ego shift accordingly so that that force in you that is pure grace, that is service-oriented and powerful and connecting, can really emerge out and then call the shots of your life. And it's, you know, there's this sort of pattern in all of this that I've seen that also Joseph Campbell talks a lot about in his work, which is in his heroic modeling of the hero's journey, that once you do engage that soul full force in you, the universe rises up to meet you and, you know, begins to constellate these synchronicities and these doors that open where they wouldn't open for anybody but you because it's part of what your destiny asks of you and also offers to you. So there's your answer, Art.
Wow. That's amazing.
In a nutshell.
Oh, yes. Well, that's interesting. And now you mentioned the soul and the ego. So I guess the soul has a lot more knowledge than the ego or knows perhaps our purpose?
Yeah, you know, this is the paradox, I think, of a life journey spiritually is that we have this part of us, the soul, which is omniscient, immortal, multidimensional, multisensory. It archives, I believe, in reincarnation. It archives all of our lifetimes. It archives all of our experiences. And yet there's an aspect to the soul that doesn't know itself through experience yet. And I think that's why we come here. We want to experience something in a creative way that awakens another unknown part of our own essence again. And then I think that that's also what I think destiny is about, is destiny is the discovery of the mystery of the soul that the soul itself has yet to experience. So the soul, but we do have etched in our soul some fundamental coordinates of our life path. And life will support those. So, you know, me falling into the work that I do, which was never consciously constructed through my own ego. I had an ambition to be an actor and to do other things with my life besides this work that I actually got called to. Nonetheless, there were already instilled in me, etched on my soul, certain patterns and events and things that were going to happen for me to put me on this path. Certainly, this is where we enter into the curious question about free will, because we do have free will. It's both true. We are fated and free. There are certain things, I think, that we cannot change, and we just need to give it up. And then there's a certain zone in our lives where we make choices and we create within what I call a flow chart of destiny. It's like the movie The Adjustment Bureau, where Matt Damon's character and the woman that he's with, and they're making these choices that are shaking up the plan. And I think that we can, similarly, not exactly like that, but we can make decisions that kind of create a flow chart of potential. And the way that I like to look at it is, you know, you're always on your path. And people, when they talk about, you know, Robert, what's my life's purpose? You know, what's my path? Well, you've been living it. You cannot but be on your path. I mean, the maybe to differentiate it is, what zone of potential do you want to live on that path? And so within that is where you make co-creative choices.
We'll be right back with more with Robert Ojado on Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. We're back with Robert Ojado.
And so within that is where you make co-creative choices based on your empowerment, your awareness, your tools of consciousness, which is something I wrote about in the book Transforming Fate into Destiny, like fundamental ways that we can co-create powerfully from the soul out. But the ego, you know, the thing I got to say about the ego as well is it gets a pretty bad rap amongst a lot of people in spirituality and self-help. And, you know, the thing that makes me laugh about that a little and also cry, both are true,
is
that the ego is the only thing driving the bad rap on the ego. You know, there's people that claim to be in the process of letting go and getting rid of their ego, and so then they go put on, you know, some robes or some crystals and some whatever else it is, and now I would just say, okay, now you just got a spiritual ego, or a yoga ego, or a Buddhist ego. It's still an ego. And there's nothing wrong with that, but it's just important to understand that ego is essential, actually, and there's a difference between you know, the ego that's detached from the mothership of the soul, which is a rogue ego, which is oftentimes dangerous, sabotaging, and, you know, reactive, compulsive. But then there's the ego that's in harmony with the soul, and that is compassionate, kind, graceful, flexible, fluid. And this is where I feel the practice of spirituality really comes through, is that it's about getting the ego to come back to the mothership and connect to the self, the deeper self, and then from that place. So, for example, I'm always going to be Robert Ojado. I mean, it's never going to change. That is the coordinates of my life path. I need to be me in that identity to do what I do. You know, what else am I going to do? Get rid of all of that, and then what am I? Just this amorphous entity? You know, I'm going to end up in the psych ward. So we need to have some coordinates of identity. The thing that I think happens for people where they get tripped up on their ego is that they think the ego is the center of their consciousness, which it is not. It is a facet, an extension, and an interface for the soul to enter into this life. And then the spiritual practice to me is, how do we make it the best, most loving, suitable vehicle through which we can engage life from the deeper self out? And the ego, you know, it's bound into survival fear. It's where we register all our trauma and out of that create drama. You know, it's, you know, and it's to really be loved into integration, not shamed into a space of, I got to get rid of you, you know, because you're not getting rid of it. It's not going anywhere. And people that say that, in my experience, that they've gotten rid of their ego are tripping up all over their ego. It's better to really, I think, know that it's a necessary facet of the journey, and that if we can bring it into harmony with the soul, that's where we really can max our destiny out. You really can. So, yeah, I think it's important that, I think our definition of the ego in terms of how we've looked at it is a shame-based thing, and we got to get rid of it, and all it is, you know, creating issues for us, is born out of this sort of split in our Judeo-Christian culture between heaven and earth, and, you know, not that everything is all one. So, of course, if all is one, then, well, that means the ego's in the game, too. It's just a matter of, you know, what kind of ego are you working with?
How do we perform soul dialogue to discover more from the soul?
I love that question. You know, I think dialogue, I'll be honest with you, I think dialoguing with the soul is actually, I would now say, a lifestyle. I think it's a way of living. It's something that you do daily. It's not something that you do once and then you go on your merry way. I think it's a way of cultivating a life for yourself. And there are various, I think, steps and tools that can be employed with that. One is shadow work. So shadow work to me is the capacity to actually look at your dark side, and not because it's negative, evil, or bad per se, but rather it is just the unknown of yourself or the place where you store, because of your shame, a lot of the things you don't like about yourself or that you think others won't accept about yourself, but maybe beautiful facets of your real nature. So in other words, what I just said is we also will shove into the shadow parts of our grace that come from our soul. So if you grew up in a family that was, let's say, a military-based family, and you are the son of a military sergeant or officer, and you happen to have the soul of a poet or of a dreamer or an artist or a healer or a cook or a chef or, you know, something that's more creative and perhaps less masculinely driven as part of your nature, and your father immediately lets you know that he's not cool with you wanting to make people happy or heal people or paint or write poetry or, you know, dream, then that part of your soul is going to go to your shadow until you finally get empowered enough to say, you know what, I can't live through your allegiance to militarism or to the army or to what you define manhood and masculinity as. If I do, this force in me that wants to heal people, cook for them, whatever, can't come out. And this force in me is my gift to life. And if I don't let it out, then destiny in its highest potential for me can't happen. And I will turn in on myself through maybe a depression or through an addiction or through whatever it is that you use to deny that grace in you, to therefore be accepted by your father, but really you're not living in authenticity. You're living in what your father's version of authenticity is for him, perhaps. Or, you know, so dialoguing with the soul is, I think, first accomplished perhaps a lot of the times by a willingness to go, what's in my shadow? What am I shoving down that my soul, that is natural to who I really am? That's one level of it. And then also another is, how do we work with the shadow? We do it through contemplation. We do it through meditation. We do it through really asking ourselves some hardcore questions that discomfort the ego, the identity of the good person we think we are. And we start to pull out of the polarity of good and evil, right, wrong, good and bad, and we look to what's just simply true. So it's not right or wrong, good or bad, that someone might have the soul of a poet. It's just what's true. What the father of that child might say is, well, that's wrong. But that it's not right or wrong. It's wrong because it discomforts maybe his own idea of his manhood or masculinity or what he expects his son to be in the world. But this is part of being authentic, is saying, you know, I'm going to have to go with what's true, not right or wrong. Right or wrong is going to get you bound up in a polarized, shame-based shadow dance with yourself. And so dialoguing with the soul is, I think, in my experience, first accomplished through compassion for yourself, which then allows you to see your shadow beyond judging yourself. The more you judge yourself, the less your psyche can reveal to you. And that means your soul. So harmonizing these things, judgment, letting go of judgment, compassion, kindness for yourself, very essential steps to dialoguing with the soul, and also really putting a value on living that way. Shadow work to me is also a lifestyle. You know, always asking yourself, what are my real intentions here? What's really going on with me? Let me slow down and tune into myself and figure out and listen to what my soul is trying to say. So to me, it's, you know, it's a dynamic way to be in the world. And there's so many tools out there to help facilitate that. I think shadow work is definitely essential. Meditation, contemplation, you know, prayer, if it works for you. I think there's so many ways that we can kind of touch into that inner aspect of the self. Even things like psychotherapy or psychoanalysis are, you know, steps into that. So I think in a lifetime, many people will probably be drawn to whatever suits them at the time that they need it to get closer to that essence of themselves.
Wow. I'm an attorney, and my field is criminal law, and I guess everyone has a shadow self, but like today I was watching a murder case. How does someone who has committed that crime or, you know, committed some violent crime or I guess maybe an addict, how do they deal with that shadow self?
Yeah, that's and how do we as a society deal with them? You know, that's a shadow issue as well, you know, and I think that one of the things that I think the biggest key to answer your question in one word is compassion. And let me define that more specifically, because I think we have a notion of compassion in our culture that is sort of synonymous with pity. And that's not really accurate. Compassion in the etymology of the word itself means to encompass something. So when a murderer or, somebody that's looking at their, an addict or, you know, anyone that's looking at their life choices and things they've done that have landed them, let's say, in court with you, or, you know, on a path where they're doing themselves in from an addiction, one of the first steps that has to be, I think, cultivated is compassion for yourself, because compassion means it's different than liking something. So we don't have to like murderers. I certainly don't. You know, I don't like murderers. I'm not saying I like pedophiles or certain things and people that steal. I don't like their behavior, but at the same time, for example, I've said this in workshops before with people. I'm like, you know, if you want to know your limits of compassion, let me throw some words at you and see how it lands in your system. And I'll say pedophile, which a lot of people then immediately are like, you know, I see their energy going.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's just a test to say, well, what can I encompass? Can I encompass somebody that has done this? And then if I say, well, let me just take it a step further. Do you know most pedophiles statistically were also sexually abused themselves as children? And that gives context to their behavior, which gives compassion, which means, oh, I get it. They just replicated their wounding. And in an attempt to get their innocence back, like a vampire took the innocence of someone else, because that's all they knew. Hmm. And it became wired into their brain as a compulsive behavior, just like for an addict. And then I can say that to people, and they'll go like, wow, that's really something when you think of it that way. I'm not just judging them as a bad person. I'm seeing their life in context of a pattern and inheritance and an adaptation of how they dealt with their wound. And that's when we look at this and we can say, wow, if someone's done something, we've all done stuff, you know, we've had to kind of look at ourselves and go, oh, you know, what kind of person am I? What am I doing here? And compassion is always the first medicine.
We'll be right back with more with Robert Ojado. You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. Let's continue our conversation with Robert Ojado.
Compassion is always the first medicine, and the connecting force to compassion is acceptance. I can accept that I did this. I don't like it, but I can accept that, you know, in my unconscious, reactive state, I killed somebody. And that doesn't mean that pedophiles, murderers, rapists, you know, thieves shouldn't pay some sort of penalty. I personally feel there's, you know, something societally that needs to happen there. But it does mean that they are always, through the grace of the universe, given permission to love themselves, even in spite of what they may have done. We're all part of the same divine force. I don't care who you are or what you've done. All is one is a supreme spiritual truth, and we can't really approach it simply when it's convenient for our lack of compassion. So when I look at someone like that, I think, you know, I try to see, and that's what I do as an intuitive, I'm seeing the patterns, I'm tracking the psyche of people, I'm looking at what's generated choices in their lives. Because if we can become aware, then we get the option to institute changes. So, but if we become aware and then judge what we're aware of, where do you think that goes? It goes right back in the shadow again. It goes right back into our shame cycle. So we have to open into a place of just accepting it. Hey, I don't like this behavior. I don't like the choices I've made in my life. We can all relate to this. But if I don't accept it, because it's already happened, it's already become part of our experience. So, you know, something rises up in your experience, you can accept it or not, but it's still what it is. And if we don't accept it, then now we're actually fighting our own life, because this is what our path has brought to us as our lessons or our growth. And so when we do that, when we engage compassion and acceptance, then we get the options of transformation that are the next steps out of that. And we can shift. And I always say that anytime we make a move to change our lives from shame, we're going to wind up back where we started in some form or another, because shame inherently says there's something inherently irrevocably defective and wrong with me. And there's a difference between looking at our choices and saying, you know, these are really harmful choices to make for my life, versus I'm a bad person inherently. You know, none of us, even dare I say a pedophile or rapist, are defined by in this lifetime or lifetimes to come one choice we've made. Who knows what we've all been in past lives? This is the grace of life in terms of learning to grow and expand and divinely connect to how we create our lives on the planet. Hmm. So for me, you know, really, it's that person sitting in there that murdered somebody, the first step they'll have to come to terms with is accepting what they did and loving themselves in spite of it, and then seeing what life offers next on their path, which may be life in prison. I mean, it may be life in prison. I mean, for some people it is, but mm-hmm. or sadly, in some places, a death penalty. But, you know, that's their path.
What are cultural spells?
Cultural spells, yeah. I came up with this when I was writing Transforming Fate into Destiny, because I think that, you know, all of us, first of all, we're all susceptible to them, and we're all under them. And they're basically cultural beliefs and thought forms that we all start to buy into. And it happens very insidiously and very unconsciously, and a lot of us were programmed with them from the time we're born. So, you know, albeit this is changing, it's still kind of a spell in our culture that men are stronger and smarter than women, which is evidenced in the pay inequality amongst men and women, or the ways in certain women are treated in certain more masculine fields of and professions. So that's a cultural spell. Is there any truth to that? Absolutely not. But it's a cultural spell because we live in a patriarchal society. So these things trickle down into these belief systems about gender, about, you know, sex. And just like it's a cultural spell right now that getting older is bad, isn't something to be desired, that therefore Botox up, you know, and that's another example of a cultural spell. Why do we believe that? There were times in different cultures that believed that getting older was a sign of dignity and to be respected. In fact, there's some tribes in the Amazon that believe as you get older, in South America, that you become a faster runner. And you know what? They do tests on their hearts and find out that the people that are 65 have stronger hearts than the people who are 35, because that's what they believe. Hmm. So we actually create our own biology through these spells, our own aging through these spells and how we respond to that. So cultural spells to me are these belief systems, and they don't always have to be negative. You know, for example, that's a cultural spell too, that you get, as you get older, you become a faster runner. That's another spell, but it's just one that enhances their longevity and their endurance. And the thing that I think is important, and the reason why I wrote about this phenomena in Transforming Fate into Destiny, is that if we're going to talk about having free will, which I'm going to define as the capacity to solely choose something for your life, we have to look at every single thing that contributes to your choices daily on all levels, from conscious to unconscious. And cultural spells tend to predominantly operate unconsciously. Therefore, when we go buy clothes, are we really buying the clothes that we like, or are we buying what we've been told is in fashion through the cultural spell that's animated at the time? Or when we go eat something, or when we, you know, buy a product somewhere, or what's really driving that? Is it something I solely intend to do, or is it, you know, the spell of my culture, like, you know, this is what I'm supposed to do? So these become, and here's the thing, this is where this all goes for me, is that we're at such a phenomenal time of consciousness where I'm even talking about this stuff, where we even look at soul-based choices, S-O-U-L and S-O-L-E, where we're thinking about, well, if I want to co-create with the utmost awareness power that I can channel in this life, what's it going to take? What kind of spiritual, if you will, technology can I engage in that process? And this is where we, you know, forget your vision boards and your law of attraction. Talk about what's unconsciously choosing for you already. Let's go to the shadow and take a look. Because that's where you're going to be the most effective in terms of becoming awakened to make a conscious decision. And that's what a lot of my work's about, is in giving people and modeling for people sort of a new way of engaging the technology of conscious choice from the soul out. And to do that, I mean, it's like I said, it's a lifestyle. It's not like you get the formula and then, oh, guess what? Now I just make, you know, destiny-based choices out of my soul all the time. No, none of us do that. You know what I mean? I'm going to go make an ego-based, fated choice in about 5 minutes. So, you know, we all, this is part of just trying to, I think, as I've matured in my work and my life, it's about waking up. We're already Buddha. We're already Buddha. It's about, can I make choices that mirror that awakened awareness? It's not about being better or getting anywhere to be better or making choices to be a better person. If you're already a Buddha, it's just about revealing the Buddha that's there. What choices reveal me versus what choices make me better? And I think that's the choices that we make out of the drive to be better are shame-based, because that's that underlying, there's something wrong with me, I got to be better. Something wrong with me, I got to be better. Versus, you know what, I'm already a rock star. So what choices can I make to reveal my star quality? And it shifts the subconscious, because when you make choices out of your shame, you're basically reinforcing to your subconscious mind, I'm a bad person, therefore I need to make this choice. So I need to lose 5 pounds to be better. What did you just really tell yourself? I'm not good enough as I am. So for me, you know, this is where all this terrain starts to come together, and cultural spells definitely play a part. And I'll say one more thing about that too. We've done a lot of work in our spiritual development, and I'd say psycho-spiritual development, around family issues and family wounding. But very few people step far enough back to ask themselves, how has my culture wounded me? How has my culture informed my empowerment, my awareness, my capacity to choose consciously? And that's a really big question, especially these days. So this is the next stage of soul development, of conscious choice development, is to say, you know what, I need to know the shadow of my own culture and what cultural spells are running like software in my consciousness and choosing for me, and I didn't even know.
Oh, yes.
And it's a fascinating thing to think about.
Well, that's interesting. That's something we can see when we look back in history or in other cultures, like slavery. You know, slavery, of course, is just a horrible thing. We realize that now, but at the time, and you wonder, how could so many people agree to think that was okay? And then you think, is there something in our culture now that's kind of like slavery that maybe a lot of people think is okay, but it's not?
Right.
And that's affecting me. And it's kind of weird, kind of hard. How do you discern that, you know?
Yeah, and that's the thing, we're always, and this is the thing that's also fascinating too, is that any time a new thought form is ready to enter the consciousness of the culture or the individual in the culture, that thought form or that belief that downloads from spirit, it first gets evaluated through cultural biases. So, you know, you start to think about, like, something, for example, the law of attraction coming as a download into our culture, and it got evaluated primarily first through a capitalist cultural bias.
We'll be right back with more with Robert Ojado. You're listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce. We're back with Robert Ojado.
It was only really looked at as a way to get more stuff or have more abundance on a more material-based level, not from, hey, how can I actually use the power of positivism to be a kinder person? Or to, you know, be more in harmony with what my soul wants me to do in this lifetime. You know, the ego took that principle, and the capitalist ego in our culture, and made it all about vision boards and manifesting houses and all this kind of stuff. And that's another, just one example of many, and that's how it tends to work. And in a culture, for example, you know, looking at some of the cultural biases of this current era, around gays and lesbians, where it's not okay for them to get married, But if we went back to Sparta, Spartan warriors had a male lover as a teacher as part of their duty to become a warrior. And that culture wasn't considered wrong at all, but obviously they were hardcore and crazy too. In a lot of ways, they killed their babies if they thought they were weak. And that was okay for them. So it's really, you know, this is where we look at the shifts of beliefs. And what I always try to come back to anchor it all and center all of it is from the soul, is how do we as a culture and society honor the inherent divinity of everybody and honor through that we are all one, meaning we're all connected. So how do we honor equanimity, equality, compassion for everybody in some way? And in the answering of that question, then we have to take it to the earth level and say, how do we create laws that honor that? How do we, like, for example, slavery isn't honoring that because we're now saying that people of dark colored skin from Africa are less than we are? Or gay and lesbians, hey, we're happy if you make us smile on our TV shows and all that kind of stuff, but we really don't want you to have equal rights in terms of what heterosexuals can do in terms of marriage. I mean, this is where we have to really question our own shadow. That buys into this idea that, you know, being straight's better than being gay. Says who? Where did we get that notion? You know, when in other cultures, some Native American traditional cultures, that you were considered special and gifted if you were a two-spirit person. So these things, it's a fascinating thing to look at. And even when we interpret history, we interpret it like, for example, the Mayan stuff, which we're interpreting through this culture's psyche. We're not from that era. We don't really know what they were really thinking. We'll never know that, really. And yet we want to impress upon it our own ideas and our own interpretations from our own template, our own Rolodex of reality. So, I mean, it is what it is, and it's what we're going to continue to do on some level. But when you come to the soul, here's the thing. The soul is not a cultural being. It's a celestial one. So this is the thing about mysticism people don't realize. When you go toward your soul, what do you think that means? It means you're shedding off layers of the conditioned identity and belief systems in there that you fused into to enter into this life.
You mentioned your radio show. Where can people hear that?
Sure. I started doing radio about 5 years ago, and since then it's gotten quite popular, and I love it as a medium to work with, and I do it twice a week. And the best place to go is to my website, ohado.com, and just go to the radio show tab there and click on it, and it'll take you right to a page where you can listen to on-demand shows and also to the live shows. Also, those that might be new to my work can find an archive of a lot of my shows on iTunes and go there and just sort of fish around and look at the titles and see what shows might speak to them. So it's the best way to access it and kind of get in the loop with the radio show is on ohado.com. And then some of the archives are on an exclusive area of ohado.com. And then some of them are also on iTunes for free.
And that's ohotto.com.
Correct.
And we're about out of time. Do you have any final thoughts before we go?
My final thoughts for anybody is just loving yourself more. You know, I think that's the work of life, is learning how to love yourself more and know that, you know, everything happening in your life is purpose. It is part of purpose. And I think my role as a teacher, and the way I try to live my life, is always using all of that, what's in front of me, as the true coordinates of my destiny and transforming fate into destiny. And I'll be doing an event, as you know, at ARE coming up here, that'll allow everyone to kind of get in the loop with, you know, Ohado style, with, you know, how I kind of see things through my eyes as an intuitive, and how to give them some really good technology coordinates and ways to really get to purpose. Because I think that's what it is, about waking up to what is trying to be lived through you and getting out of your own way.
All right. Well, thanks again for coming on the show.
All right. It was my pleasure. I can't believe how fast that went. It felt like 10 minutes.
Well, it's time for the Thought for the Day. And today's Thought for the Day will be read by Allison Ray, my wife. Well, hello.
Hi, how are you today?
Oh, good. And what's today's Thought for the Day?
Today's Thought for the Day is 451-2. That contentment that can only come with the knowledge of His peace abiding ever with thee. For with His peace there comes contentment. No matter what may be the vicissitudes of life, whether in trials as of the mental surroundings, whether in the trials as of material conditions or positions, there can come, with that peace, that contentment of heart and mind, that he is in his holy temple, and all is well with those who have made him the ideal.
Hmm. Well, what does that mean to you?
Oh, this is one of those beautiful readings that, to me, talks about how important it is to have, not only have an ideal, but also have a spiritual principle and a guiding force in life, whether it's Jesus or whatever somebody needs to have as their guiding ideal. And that there's going to be trials. We are going to have challenges. There's no getting around that. That's life. And they can be material or they can be mental. And yet, by focusing on our ideal and moving in that direction, we can hopefully have a little bit of peace.
Oh, yes. Even with the vicissitudes of life, the stressful changes that may be unpleasant, we can still have that inner peace by trusting in God.
Exactly.
Well, thank you for doing the Thought for the Day today.
Thanks. Have a great one.
That's all the time we have for the show today. Thanks to Robert Ojado for talking to us about the soul's destiny. To find out more, go to ohado.com. That's OHOTTO.com. Remember that he'll be speaking at the upcoming conference at the ARE, Transforming Your Fate into Destiny, A New Dialogue with Your Soul. To find out more, go to edgarcasey.org, click on Events, and then click on Conferences. Thanks also to Allison Ray for the thought for the day, and most of all to you, the listener. Thanks for listening to Reflections, the Wisdom of Edgar Cayce.